Accession number 9968, Reel 2.
Mr. Smith, Reel 2.
When we got to Spitsbergen, some of the Marines dashed ashore quickly and took possession of the radio station before any messages could be sent out because, of course, it was almost entirely occupied by the Germans. They just did as they were... The people on there just did as they were told and worked as they were told. Anyway, we had two cruisers with us. Nigeria, I think I'm right in saying there was the Nigeria... Oh, just a second. And Penelope, Anthony, and there was another cruiser with us, and I just forget her name. And anyway, the troops were quickly ashore, the Canadian troops, and everything was grabbed. All installations were grabbed very quickly. And then we began to meet people coming aboard, and there were Russians. We met Russians. They came aboard and they all went down into the feeding area. They fed them all. They were all down there. I'll never forget the terrible smell from them. Shocking smell down in the place where they ate. They smelled as if they'd never had a bath for months. And then we sailed for where we didn't know. But eventually it turned out that we were off to Archangel.
Just before we go on to that, can you tell me what Spitsbergen looked like?
Spitsbergen had snow on it and it was almost down to the water's edge. In fact, I've got some photographs of the coast and I believe it freezes up late September and I think it was done for that reason, the raid, to stop other ships getting in and causing some trouble after we'd gone. Anyway, I photographs of the... ice and snow almost down to the water's edge, but it was completely desolate. And anyway, we sailed for what turned out to be Archangel with all these Russian miners. They'd been compelled to work, there'd no option. And there were women, children. And eventually we arrived at Archangel, and all I remember of the place is that it was very drab. And I remember one ship nearby us, and there was livestock roaming about on the ship, chickens and hens on deck, and we unloaded these people and then we set sail again for Spitsbergen. I can't remember how long we stayed in Archangel. I just can't.
Well, in what way was it drab?
The weather, everything was drab, dull, you know, there was no colour about anything. It was so drab. And
was it a big town or what?
Well, I don't think it was all that big, Archangel. It didn't look that big to me because we didn't see much of it. We didn't go ashore. We weren't allowed ashore. The Russians were taken ashore separately. And I don't know how long we stayed there, in fact.
Did the Russians seem glad to be taken from Spitsbergen?
No, I don't think they did. They didn't seem too pleased about it at all. But anyway, we sailed again, went back to Spitsbergen, and... when we got there, the Canadians had been doing demolition work and I think they'd had one casualty, that was all. It was a stone going up in the air and coming down on top of one of the lads and he was brought aboard, injured. But apart from that, there was nothing going off. There was a Norwegian colony and they were quite nice people, but I got the impression they were a bit pro-German. In fact, they scoffed at our efforts at times and... there were times when it got to the stage when some of the some of the soldiery aboard were threatening to chuck them overboard because they became quite offensive, and they brought magazines, German magazines, which were supplied to them, and it was full of depressing news about Allied shipping being sunk and how badly the war was going for the Allies. And another point I remember about them. They used to stay on deck at night late playing, balalaikas or guitars or something. Something like that. And they played music late at night and stayed on deck as long as possible. And then we got the word that they were evacuating the island. One time during the stay, I remember we got an alarm that there were aircraft, German aircraft about, but I think it proved out to be false. I think it was quite false.
In what way did these Norwegians scoff?
Well, they scoffed at the efforts our lads were making against the Germans and how well the Germans were doing. In fact, it was all there. They'd been brainwashed by this propaganda magazine, German magazines, which were obviously specially prepared for them, and they'd been well and truly brainwashed. And they really thought that the Germans were winning the war. But I think we left two or three men on that island, and they were trappers, and they asked to be left. And we left quite a lot of foodstuffs for them, and that was the end of the people on Spitsbergen, as far as I remember. Oh, I do remember that there was quite a lot of livestock, and they sent a party ashore to shoot them all. There were animals and fowls, one thing or another, and they just shot them all, the livestock, and blew the radio station up. And that was the end of that. Oh, before we left, explosive charges were placed in... Oh, there were quite a lot of boats around the harbour, and we were all leaned over the railings, just guessing when they were going to go up, and there were time charges in each one, and the charges just blew one after another, and each boat was blown to pieces. And then eventually we sailed, and while we're at sea, as I said, the Norwegians were all right, but they were inclined to belittle our efforts, I thought, and it caused quite a lot of animosity among the lads. And I believe they were all left somewhere on the Clyde, a place somewhere on the Clyde. I did hear once, but I've forgotten now. But they were kept on the Clyde somewhere till the end of the war, I believe. And on the way home, we encountered nothing really, except I remember Nigeria. What was the other ship I said?
Penelope.
That was the one. Penelope and Nigeria, two cruisers, and Antony Antelope and another one, destroyers escorting us. And from what I heard, how true it is, I don't know, but they said that they'd caught a small German convoy going down the Norwegian coast, and there were congratulatory messages signalled by flag and by the lights across. And apparently they did sink some ships. But then we put into Glasgow, and all the news media were waiting, and of course, we were told what we couldn't say too much, and because the Germans still thought we were there. And from what I could gather in literature I read after the war, it went to the extent that they actually did send Scharnhorst up there, but we'd long gone by that time. And we got back, and the news media didn't bother us. Officers with us were specially appointed to give them details of what had been going on. And that was the end of it. And we got 14 days leave. And I can't just remember the name of the commander. He was a Canadian. I do remember it sometimes. But he said we'd all get a leave. And we did. We got 14 days leave. And then we were off again on other ships, merchant ships. I joined a tanker. I think, I'm not sure the sequence is absolutely correct, but I joined a tanker, the San Terso, and all she was fit for was scrap. She was over 30 years old, and we sailed to Halifax, Nova Scotia, and while we're on the way, we saw no action whatever going there, except a couple of submarine alarms, but nothing happened. And from what I could gather, she was a naval supply vessel for fuel oil. And we did fill up at Halifax, Nova Scotia. And she was in dock for quite a few days. And she'd sprung a couple of plates from what I could gather. And then we just sailed back to Northern Ireland, to Londonderry, and pumped what we'd got left. We refuelled the escort ships all the way over. And what we'd got left, we pumped into a tanker called the Dolphin. She was anchored in Londonderry, and then we were off again to our own depot.
What date have we reached by now?
I think it was about October 41, the end of October 41, I think, because I remember The chief mate said to me, if you've got any sense, lad, you'll get off the ship before the winter gales start right. He said, because she'll break her back. As sure as you're there, he said, she'll break her back. He said, she should never be at sea. And anyway, I was taken off her. And I joined the Empress of Russia. And we loaded, I think there were, oh, I can't tell you how many troop ships there were. There seemed to be about 30. But I joined the Empress of Russia, as I say, and I remember, she was the Empress of Canada's sister ship, but she carried troops, some from this locality in Bradford, and they'd been billeted all round Bradford. In fact, we got quite friendly with them. Some had been billeted in the Park Avenue, on the Park Avenue sports grounds, and some in Manningham, in houses there, in private billets. Mainly, the ones I got to know were RASC personnel, because they used to take instruction on maintenance of engines, tank, I suppose, and wagons, army wagon engines, on deck with instructors with them. And we went on a five-and-a-half-month trip. We had a crossing-the-line ceremony, and which I've got photographs of. And we put into... Freetown, West Africa, and she was, unfortunately, she was a coal burner, a very dirty coal burner too, and you used to have to have a bath every time you came off watch. She used to belch bits of grit and smoke all over the place. You were filthy. Anyway, we had the crossing the line ceremony, and then we called in at Cape Town. Some of the troops went ashore at Cape Town, and we spent a few days there. We got some shore leave. Then we went up to Cape Town to Durban. And Durban, it seemed then that we were going to Singapore, but we got to Colombo and Ceylon. And we turned round. Apparently, Singapore was about to fall or had fallen, and we took on refugees, service personnel's families, wives, children, and there are survivors of the two warships. Can you stop it now? I can't remember. And we took on survivors of Prince of Wales and Repulse, mainly Repulse, as far as I saw, and they came back with us to England.
What condition did they seem to be in?
Well, they seemed all right. They didn't seem to be too frightened. There was one woman, she seemed a bit hysterical, because I remember with us being on the guns, we were privileged, really. We were in for what you could call first-class accommodation, and we got first-class meals. This being because we had to be close to the guns. We had to be quickly onto the guns in the event of an alarm. And that was about all there was to it. We were with her 5.5 months, and I developed prickly heat going, and it stayed with me until we got back. The MO or MOs didn't seem to know about prickly heat at all, because they'd been stationed in England. And that's what it turned out to be. It worried me for a while, wondering what all this itching was all over. Anyway, we came back to Liverpool, and it started to go as soon as I got into a cooler climate. Of course, we'd been having showers with salt water, and I think that caused it, post-closing on salt, you see. And the next one, we got leave, of course. I forget how long now. Usually we got 7 days for 3 months, 14 days for 6 months. And I think that was about the maximum we got, 14 days. And then I joined a tanker, the Marathon. She was Norwegian, with a sprinkling of... well, there was a couple of Swedes, and the captain was Norwegian. Apparently, she'd been running most of the time she'd been in action. She'd been built quite a few years, and she'd been running to Galveston most of that time, from what I could gather. But it was hard to find somebody who could speak decent English.
This is Galveston in Texas?
Galveston, yeah. Actually, Baytown, there was the port. But we used to go into Galveston and on the bus to Houston, you know.
How did you find these Norwegians? Did you find any pro-German feeling amongst them?
No, we didn't. But I found that the steward, who I became quite friendly with, he was a man of about in his 40s, I should say. He said if he got the chance, he would go home regardless of what. He'd two children, and he said he'd go home regardless if he got the chance. But, of course, he never did, because when I left the marathon, I went back to barracks, and I went into a pub in Leith, down the road from Edinburgh, and a chap came up to me, and he seemed to recognise me, and he said, you were a gunner, weren't you, on the marathon? I said, yeah, yes, I was. He said, do you know she's gone? I said, no, I didn't. He said, yeah, he said, after you left her, she went again, and I believe she was carrying high-octane aviation fuel, and she just went, blew up in the air. He said, everybody went with her. He said, and that was the end of her, so I missed it just by going home to get married, which I did after I left her.
What did the attitude of the Norwegians aboard the marathon seem to be towards the war?
We didn't discuss it a lot. We didn't discuss it a lot. But I know this. There was one incident that really riled me, and it happened when we put into New York on the way home loaded. Apparently it was a custom for harbour pilots to bring newspapers aboard for the ship's skippers. And this chap came aboard and he seemed a bit mouthy, you know, and I don't think he was over keen on the British. He brought these newspapers aboard and I was up on the bridge watch, and the skipper, of course, was up there, but the pilot, the American pilot, had taken over to take us through to an anchorage. And it became quite boring. He made rude remarks about the British effort, and he produced one newspaper, and he said, just look at this, he said. Chappie, I got a medal for this. Well, he was an RAF pilot, and apparently he'd done something quite worthwhile, well worth a medal. And our skipper smiled, and he said, I don't know if you know it, he said, but this lad here is English, he knows what you're talking about. And he said, well, it's true, isn't it? And I immediately blew me top. I said, well, do you know, I said, your lads are all right, I said, but they come back to come over to us in England, I said, and we hear about a chest full of medals. I said, they've never been in action, have they? I said, the women and children in Liverpool and London and places like that are getting bombed every night. I said, and they don't get any medals. I said, but your lads get one for it in the bullseye on the range. I said, I don't like this at all, your attitude. I don't think it's nice at all. I said, you've never seen anything here in New York. You want to get the facts right before you start talking.
How did he react to that?
He got quite annoyed and stomped away, you know. He walked away. And our skipper, the Norwegian chap, was quite a nice chap, smiled and he just shrugged his shoulders, you know. And that was the end of that incident. And we sailed and nothing particular happened. I don't remember anything. We always got submarine alerts, but I don't remember anything particularly frightening that we saw. But then, of course, I hope I've got this in sequence right. I hope I have. But I joined the Clan McNair. And she was a boat, from what I could gather, that should never have been in deep water. Like, not going to the area she did go to. And we sailed to up to what was then Portuguese East Africa, Beira and Lourenço Marques. And when we were in Lourenço Marques, I remember him, I think it was Beira. There were blacks there who apparently only came down to work for a week or a month or two and then went back and bought a wife or something, so I was told, with what they earned on the ships. And the jungle came right down, I think it was in Beira. No, was it Lourenço Marques, I think it was. The jungle came right down to the ship. And I remember once a lad came up to me, he was obviously an Indian, and he asked me if I could sell him some ammunition. And I said, why ask me? I don't have any ammunition, which of course was the obvious thing I was going to say. And he said, come on, he said, I can tell by your haircut, you're one of the ship's gunners. And I said, what do you want 303 ammunition for, or 30? He says, we use it for elephant hunting round here. So I said, well, I'm sorry, I don't have any. And then we got a chap calling on the ship, and he said we had to go, well, he said we had to go down and see the British consul in Lorenzo Marx. And when we got down there, I met this chap, and since then I found out, I'm nearly sure it was Malcolm Muggeridge, because he gave us a pep talk, and he told us this certain cafe, I think it was, I think they call it the Kitty Cat, and they had a singer there. I think they called him Americo Marx. And he didn't advise us to go in there at all. He said, the people who go in there are mainly Italians and Germans. He said, and they're quite likely to be listening to everything you say. He said, don't talk to anyone about where you've been, what you're carrying, or where you're going, which, of course, we did. But we used to get some fun, really, because there were some ships in there, Italian and German, and they used to, I think it was more of a march down to the ship every morning or every few days to clean up on the ship, and they used to get ribald remarks from the ships, the British ships that were in, or the British people who were in service. Of course, we wore civilian clothes. We were given a sports coat and flannels. That was about all. With the rest, we provided ourselves. But we did wear these to try and kid them that we weren't service personnel. But obviously, they knew we were. And they knew there were some aboard, because the gun was plainly seen on the stern, the 4-inch gun. And the breech was taken out, and it was put into the care of the Portuguese, I think. They kept the breech while we were in port. And on top of that, the local newspaper published details of times of sailing, so they knew exactly when we were going to sail. But it was quite a nice place, nice villas and everything the Portuguese had built. But the boys being young, the girls used to sit out on the balconies, and they were always chaperoned. And the young lads, the service personnel, the young merchant seamen, always yelling after the girls, which they didn't like very much, the Portuguese. They thought it was a bit common. But anyway, there was no harm done, and we eventually left there. And we'd been on the beach. Oh, we went back to, I think it was Durban. Yes, Durban. And we were on the way home. We were expecting to be home, I think they said, for Christmas, but I'm not sure of that.
Would this be 1942?
No, 43, I think. I think that was 43. 42 early, or late 42. I'm finding it hard now. 42, I think it was, late 42, because we expected being home for Christmas. And we were all sprawled out on the beach at Durban, and one of the radio operators came down, and he said, I've got some bad news for you, lads. He said, we're not going home straight away. He said, you won't be home when you think you will. We said, well, where are we going? He said, I don't know. He says, but, and I believe, they used to get, the Merchant Navy used to get messages, I believe, daily almost, from some place in England. It escapes me now, the place. But the Merchant Navy were given their orders, I think, almost daily from these transmitters, and that we were involved in that anyway. And we were told we'd be sailing. And when we got to sea, we set off from Durban, no escort, and we were, I'm sure it was weeks. I'm sure it was weeks. We got to Punta Arenas, and then we started really hitting the really bad weather from Cape Horn, from the Magellan Straits. Around the Magellan Straits, the weather came. And we took a pilot on at Punta Arenas, and he brought a suitcase with him. Apparently was going on his holidays. And about that time, I'd had this trouble with my side, an operation on an abscess near the appendix, and it was the greasy food I'd been eating, I think. The doctor came to see me, and he pulled one or two teeth out. It seemed to be the job for the doctor as well, did dental work. And then we went through the Magellan Straits, and we took the pilot with us up to Valparaiso. And some of the crew pointed out to me ruins, and they said that these were the ruins caused by an earthquake about 1930 or thereabouts. And we didn't stop there long. We put the pilot ashore, and then we went up to the Panama Canal. We went through the Panama Canal, stopped at Colon, and we went ashore there. And we were the guests of a clergyman. He gave us quite a nice time, buns and tea and all the rest of it. And his helpers were all Panamanians. I believe they speak Spanish. I think it was Spanish they spoke. And he gave us a lot of magazines to pass the time on. And we listened to an American Army band in Cologne. I remember that plainly. And we went through the canal. I've got some postcards of... one or two postcards of it. And then out. And is it Costa Rica we came out by? And I remember when we came out through the canal and out into the sea at the open end, we spotted what we thought was a submarine. Most of the crew saw it. And we turned about try and make the aim difficult, but apparently it was a huge log. And then somebody thought they'd seen somebody on it, but it turned out to be seabirds, and they were just flapping their wings. But anyway, off we went again. And we went calling at ports up the American coast. We joined convoys going up there, tanker convoys coming from Texas and thereabouts, and up to New York. And I remember in New York, the Staten Island ferry passing us, and with the Norwegian flag up, and all the girls and all the merchant seamen on deck waving to the girls. I remember that very well. And then we joined a convoy from Halifax. We went to Halifax, Nova Scotia, and we joined a convoy, and I don't know if it was Liverpool or Glasgow we went to, but that was the end of the Clan MacNair. And, of course, then the next one was into joining the Ocean Strength. The Ocean Strength, I forget what line she was.
But was that just a freighter?
It was a freighter, yeah. And she was going bound for Russia. And I did two Russian convoys on her and to Murmansk. And another time then, we called it Murmansk, but apparently there were no unloading facilities available. And they sent us off to Molotovsk, a place that doesn't seem to be on any map I've ever seen, through the ice in the White Sea. And two Russian icebreakers took us through the ice. It was frozen up. And two Russian icebreakers, and I remember them, they were called the Joseph Stalin and the October Revolution. And I remember these taking us to Molotovsk, and I heard that this was really a timber port in normal times, although I can't find it on the map. And I finished my seagoing time with the Ocean Strength on the Russian convoys. But on the last one I did... Oh, I'm sorry, I'm overlooking something that you might be interested in. Going up, I think we lost one merchant ship on the last trip I did, and then there was a ship in front of us, a naval... heavy destroyer, I think it was the Maratha, and I was on watch at midnight, and there was an alarm, and I remember, well, I've read about it since, that apparently she picked up a U-boat, dashed after it, but her engines drew two acoustic torpedoes onto her, and she exploded. I was on the stern, and I saw her explode. I doubt if anybody on the ship did, because I just happened to be looking astern when I saw this, and there'd been this U-boat alarm, and she just exploded like a firework display. And anyway, afterwards, one of the merchant seamen said to me, I believe that was the Fort McMurray.